Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much. We are here on a lovely Sunday morning. And you know why? Because we are going to talk politics, something that you probably haven't been talking about for the last month or more, or 2 months, or who knows why. I don't know why. Probably because you haven't been seeing any on TV, you haven't heard about it on the radio, and you certainly haven't gotten any flyers in your mailbox. So we're going to take care of that today. Our guest, Jennifer Lawless, Dr. Jennifer Lawless from the UVA Department of Politics. And good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here with us.
I'm thrilled to be here with you.
Well, good. That's how I feel. I'm thrilled to be here every Sunday. Jennifer Lawless, Commonwealth Professor of Politics at the University of Virginia. She's the author or co-author of 6 books, including Women on the Run, Gender, Media, and Political Campaigns in a Polarized Era. She's an associate editor of the American Journal of Politics, Science. Graduated from Union College with a degree in political science and holds both a master's and a PhD from Stanford University. And we're very lucky to have Dr. Lawless on the show to talk politics. Something we really haven't done a lot of, other than having Ms. Coburn on to start the month of October. We just let all those flyers show up in your mailbox until today. But it is something that we want to do with the show. So you do this on a regular basis in your classroom.
Every day.
Every day. How many students?
I'm actually not teaching this semester, but for the last 15 years, almost every day. And over the course of that time, thousands and thousands of students have come in and we've talked about campaigns, elections, representation, and what each election cycle means. So this is old hat.
So in an election semester, you're not teaching?
This is my first semester at UVA. I just came from Washington, D.C. So I'm working on a new book. I'm doing a lot of research and I'm trying to do everything that I can to talk about the research to the media more broadly so that people have a better sense of what to expect this election cycle and how it fits in the broader spectrum.
So we're very lucky to have you. Thank you for being here. Let's start. We're just going to jump right into it. We're going to talk about the midterms. Tuesday, November 6th, 2 days from today. Polls have been suggesting the blue wave. True?
There will likely be some sort of blue wave, but I think at this point it's unclear whether it's going to be a tsunami or the equivalent of throwing a little pebble in a puddle. It's likely that the Democrats will take back the House of Representatives. The size of that margin, though, is up in the air. And it's unlikely that the Senate will flip control. So it's likely that the Republicans will continue to hold control of the Senate. So there's definitely Democratic enthusiasm. The Democrats in at least one chamber of Congress will likely make substantial gains, but we're probably not talking about a fundamental rehaul of Washington.
And what makes you say these things? Are you basing this on the study for your book? Are you basing this on your reading of articles in various newspapers and other media around the country, and listening to NPR versus, you know, all the other things around the world? Where do you get your beliefs from?
Well, several sources. The first, obviously, are the polls. I'm looking at them just the way that most political junkies are. But the second have to do with political science studies dating back decades that have shed light on different trends. And usually during off-year elections, the party in power loses a number of seats. And that's what we expect this time around. Trump and the Republicans will likely lose a handful at least, and probably a few dozen seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. That's typical. It's largely a response to the fact that no administration is able to deliver all of its promises in those first 2 years, and voters often backpedal a little. We also know that from political scientists, that the economy is an important issue, but it's not the only issue. And Americans place core values very high on their list of how they arrive at their vote choice as well. And right now, especially among Democrats, there's a level of enthusiasm that suggests they don't like the direction the country is headed. And their enthusiasm, according to polling data, outstrips that of Republicans. So the likelihood of the Republicans losing at least control of the House is based both on political scientists' conclusions dating back many, many decades, and the current media environment and the polling environment that suggests that the candidates this time around who are running on the Democratic side probably have an edge.
Again, our guest today, Dr. Jennifer Lawless from UVA's Department of Politics. Dr. Lawless, you have now mentioned polling several times in your first few minutes here. How has the method of polling changed since 2016? Because as we saw at the 2016 presidential election, that proved to be somewhat unbelievable, disbelief. And if it hasn't changed, then why should we believe what it's saying now? No one thought that President Trump was going to win that election, even up until the point that he was raised his hand as the numbers say, I am now the president. And so why should we believe that everyone, all the polls are now saying Republicans are going to lose seats?
That's a great question, and it's completely reasonable for people to be skeptical of the polls. But when differentiating 2018 from 2016, I'd say a couple of things. The first is that the 2016 polls that were mostly unreliable were national polls that had Hillary Clinton winning. And in fact, Hillary Clinton did win the national popular vote by more than 3 million. The problem, of course, is that these national polls in a presidential election don't really tell us much because the president is chosen by the Electoral College, which means that state-by-state polls are much more important. So right off the bat, when we're looking at 2018, we're focused on polling in specific states and in specific districts. Those polls are far more relevant than these national polls that talk about the generic ballot and whether people favor Democrats or Republicans. So it's not just this national generic ballot that suggests that the Democrats are ahead. We also see that in many of these states, in many of the competitive districts, as well as in many of the competitive states' Senate races, the Democrat is actually ahead. The other thing that's important to keep in mind is that pollsters learned from 2016 that they might have to gauge the likelihood of somebody turning out to vote a little bit differently. We saw Donald Trump was able to get people who were disaffected, who hadn't turned out, who said they were going to vote, but had nothing in their history to suggest that they actually would, go to the polls. And that is now incorporated into these models because those people who were not traditionally seen as reliable or likely voters now are. And that's going to probably also lend a little bit more accuracy to what we're seeing this time around.
You mentioned Hillary Clinton. Why is Hillary Clinton still in the media? Her name comes up regularly from President Trump in a very negative way. But she continues to put herself in the media. And that only continues to put such a negative and I'll say that this is my opinion, this seems to continue to put such a negative stain on the Democrats repeatedly, strongly, and therefore put a lot of energy on and give in to the Republicans every time she puts herself up on up in front of a camera.
I think it's fair to say that the emotions coming out of the 2016 election still 2 years later are quite raw. And we see this on both sides of the aisle. Donald Trump does not seem to have come to grips with the fact that he won, and he's still campaigning against somebody that he soundly defeated. The election was never called into question. The integrity of the results were not called into question. Certainly, Russian interference has been at the forefront, but nobody on either side of the aisle suggested that Donald Trump was not a legitimate president. Yet he seems to constantly be relitigating this, in large part because he was successful when his opponent was Hillary Clinton. It's more uncertain how he would do when his opponent is somebody else. And Clinton, on her part, I think, can't believe she lost. And she can't believe she lost to Donald Trump. And, you know, this is not a great situation for either party to be in, because you'll remember that both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were the least liked and least popular candidates that each party had put up in contemporary history. So neither of them is really doing much to bridge the divide that the 2016 election created. I just think neither of them can help it.
So let's move on to the actual 2018 election. We seem to have a large number of women candidates. Why is that? Let's talk about why there are a large number of women candidates in 2018.
Well, I think it's first important to put the numbers into perspective. So women have always been severely underrepresented in U.S. political institutions. Right now, they're only about 20% of the U.S. Congress. They're only 12% of state governors, only a quarter of state legislators, and only about 10% of big city mayors. So women have always been underrepresented, and this is particularly surprising given that when women run for office overall, they're just as likely as men to win their elections, they're just as able to fundraise, and separate and apart from the presidential level, their media coverage generally looks very much the same as well. And so one of the big explanations for why we've had so few women in politics is because they're less likely than men to run for office in the first place. And this gender gap in their ambition to throw their hats into the ring has been a leading explanation for why men have come to dominate or remained dominant in our political system. 2018 changed that a little bit because women were particularly turned off by the Trump administration. And from the moment that he won the election to the time that he was inaugurated, it became clear that women who were dissatisfied with the 2016 outcome weren't going to just take it laying down. And so we saw unprecedented levels of activism. We saw unprecedented numbers of women marching, of donating, of registering to vote, and of saying that they were interested in running for office themselves. And so it was largely, these numbers are largely on the Democratic side of the aisle in direct reaction to Donald Trump. That's what the polling data show us. That's what public opinion surveys show. And that's what surveys of these candidates themselves indicate. Now, the one thing to keep in mind here, though, that often gets lost in this discussion of how 2018 is a year of the woman, is that a record number of male Democrats decided to run for office also, because they were very, very turned off. Progressive men thought that the country was headed in the wrong direction, too. And as a result, when we look at the overall number of primary candidates, women were only slightly a greater proportion than they've been in previous midterm elections. So we had very, very crowded fields. We had hundreds more men and women running than usual. But our political campaigns and elections were still very, very male dominated.
Did the Me Too movement have anything to do with this, or was it? Are we just talking about Donald Trump?
I think the Me Too movement played a really substantial role because it kept the narrative that Trump is bad for women alive. Usually what happens after an election is people are upset that their side lost and they bury their heads and they get back to work for the next election cycle. But there's at least a little bit of a lull and the campaign messages change. We didn't see that this time around. From the minute that Donald Trump announced that he was running for president, a lot of progressives, women and men alike, were concerned. When the Access Hollywood tape emerged in October of 2016, that was fuel to the fire. And then Trump's win, coupled with all of these men behaving badly in other industries who were held accountable when the president of the United States was not, I think sustained the energy and the enthusiasm that a lot of progressives had from the minute that Clinton lost.
Again, our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Lawless from UVA's Department of Politics as we talk politics 16 minutes after the hour here on the Sunday before Election Day. I hope everyone is getting ready to vote. The important part is voting. It's nothing more difficult than having your candidate lose and then finding out that only 15 or 20 or 30% of the population voted and being so unhappy that such a small percentage of the population got out to vote. Did you find, Dr. Lawless, that, or would you make the statement that the Obama presidential organization satisfied women and that slowed the pace of the female candidacy group from 2008 to 2016?
So women's candidacies haven't really slowed. 2018 represents a pretty substantial uptick. But in every election cycle dating back to 1992, we've seen gradual, sometimes incremental or even glacial increases in the number of women running for office. And in that entire time, there's only been one time where we saw a setback. In 2010, the total number of women serving in the House went down by a couple. But that wasn't because they were women. It was because Republicans had a really good year and Democrats are more likely than Republicans to have female candidates on the ballot. So it's not that women were satisfied and that's why they weren't turning out or that's why they weren't becoming candidates. It's that they were, just not at the pace that we're seeing this time around. It seems that Donald Trump has really motivated and the Me Too movement has really sustained interest in running for office.
Are these, as we have all these, a larger percentage of women as candidates, are you saying that all these women are Democrats?
Almost entirely. So all of the buzz is really happening on the Democratic side of the aisle. And to put that into perspective, 42% of the candidates the Democrats ran this year were women. 14% of Republican candidates were women. And the Republicans are also seeing an unprecedented number of women retiring from Congress. So it's likely that when the next Congress convenes, not only will the Democrats have a record number high, but the Republicans will probably also have suffered a net loss.
What are the expectations of women running regardless of Democrats or Republicans? What are the expectations of winning or losing?
Well, we've known now dating back for about 30 years that when women run, they're just as likely as similarly situated men to win. So by that, I mean that female incumbents will likely win at astronomical rates, just like male incumbents. A lot of female challengers will lose just like male challengers. And in open seats, women on both sides of the aisle have just as good a chance as becoming the victor. What's really important is the extent to which these candidates represent the views and the partisanship of the district where they're running. That's what it comes down to. And that's the case regardless of whether you're a man or a woman on the ballot.
So let's take a break. 20 minutes after the hour today, our guest again, Dr. Jennifer Lawless, UVA's Department of Politics. And that's what we're doing today, talking politics. It's the Sunday before Election Day. Hang tight. Don't go anywhere. Politics is our gig. All right. I'm back. I hope you are too. Dr. Lawless stayed in her seat. We don't let him up.
Nowhere.
We sit down. We put on the seatbelt. So we've been talking about women candidates. Let's talk about women voters. So the women candidates, you said, have increased. How about female voters? What's going on that side of the ballot?
Well, it turns out that for decades now, certainly since the 80s, women have turned out to vote at greater rates than men have, and they also comprise a larger proportion of registered voters than men. So it's completely accurate to say that it's women who generally decide elections because they're the ones who are taking suffrage most seriously. The other thing I would note is that there's been a big gender gap in elections since 1980 on the presidential side and since 1986 when it comes to Congress. And by that, I mean that women overall are more likely to support Democratic candidates than men are. This doesn't mean that they always support the Democrat, but it means that the share of the vote that they give to Democrats is greater than men. So the Democratic Party has basically become a party that is more amenable to women, broadly speaking, and the Republican Party tends to favor male voters, broadly speaking. So as we look into our crystal balls to figure out what's going to happen in 48 hours, it's important to keep in mind that Democratic candidates will likely be propelled into positions of power if that's what female voters decide to do.
But when we look at issues that when we look in the news, when we see the report of something like the TMZ issue with President Trump, where he states quite openly that, yes, he touched a female in what many of us would say inappropriately. And then you still see women standing at his rally supporting him, which to me seems, I don't understand that. And then you see, when you see a poll, that a fair percentage of women voted for him. Obviously, that issue wasn't the piece that decided whether or not that gender was going to vote for him or not. I'm confused.
Right. So I think the best way to explain this is with a hypothetical. And so imagine that you're a card-carrying sexist. I know that you're not, but imagine that you're a card-carrying sexist.
I might want to ask other people.
So imagine that you're a card-carrying sexist and that you don't think women should be in politics. You don't think women should have the right to vote. You don't think women should have the right to drive. You certainly don't think women should work outside the home. And you go to vote on Election Day, and let's say hypothetically that you're a Republican. You go to vote, and it turns out that on the ballot, there's a man who's running as a Democrat, and there's a woman running as a Republican. Now, you're a sexist, and you think it's awful, but you're still going to probably cast your ballot for that woman who's the Republican, because the only thing more important to you than making sure that we maintain traditional women's roles is making sure that the Democrats don't come to power. And so what we see is that the partisan affiliation of a candidate and how that matches up to a voter is more important than anything else. And at the end of the day, whether a candidate has a D or an R in front of his or her name matters way more than the presence or the absence of a Y chromosome in his or her DNA. And so what we see are people on Election Day in 2016 telling pollsters that they did not approve of the way that Donald Trump handled the Access Hollywood tape, that they do not think he's a good representative of the country, that they have concerns about his temperament, that they don't like the way that he treats women. And they still voted for him because he was a Republican who supported this Republican worldview. And their alternative was to vote for a candidate who might not have a, quote, woman problem, but who supported a whole panoply of issues and positions that they don't support. And so what we see is people on both sides of the aisle often willing to sweep under the rug very, very important and significant indiscretions of the candidates, because at the end of the day, they vote their partisanship over everything else.
Right. I saw a very interesting piece today, yesterday, that someone who does ministry issues had posted something on Facebook that said, do you believe that if Jesus was alive today, would he be at a Trump rally or would he be down at the caravan? And I, you know, it makes me wonder if you put that in front of a fair number of folks on the religious right who are supporting President Trump, would they still be, how would they explain away the decision that they're currently making?
Right. And motivated reasoning is exactly what's at play here. When you ask Christian evangelicals in particular how they can support Donald Trump, given some of his moral indiscretions, how they could support Brett Kavanaugh if Christine Blasey Ford's allegations were true and if they believed her, a lot of what you heard was, at the end of the day, it's not about any one person. It's about policy. And these are people that will help ensure that anti-choice justices go on the Supreme Court. These are people that will help push Donald Trump's tax agenda forward. They're people who will make sure that the government doesn't get too big. They're people who will support draining the swamp. Now, whether Donald Trump and his administration can actually do any of these things is a different question. But people who are in tune with a Republican agenda tend to convince themselves that he can and that they're willing to take all of the crummy stuff that comes with him so that they can achieve that outcome. And we're seeing that in terms of the way that Donald Trump is talking about the caravan and how religious leaders, who should be appalled by a lot of his language, are often standing by.
Again, our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Lawless, UVA's Department of Politics. Let's talk about some of the specific races that are going on across the United States that have been mentioned as races that will possibly tip whether or not the House or the Senate will become blue or red. So one of the ones that's getting the most conversation has to do with Texas Senator Ted Cruz, current Republican, holding the seat, and Beto O'Rourke running as Democrat. Cruz rejected CNN's offer of the town hall debate and gave Beto O'Rourke the entire hour. That was considered quite unusual. Talk about the position.
Well, I think part of the reason that Cruz did it was to shore up his Republican credentials, because remember that according to Republicans, CNN is the enemy of the people. And so granting them coverage of a town hall or any sort of debate would be in some ways legitimizing them, which, even if Ted Cruz thinks is a good idea, probably wouldn't necessarily go over that well with the people that he's trying to motivate to turn out to vote. The other thing that's important here to keep in mind is that Ted Cruz is finding himself between a rock and a hard place. In 2016, he differentiated himself from Donald Trump. He basically refused to endorse Donald Trump at the convention, and he and Trump had probably the most heated exchanges over the course of that primary that any two candidates did. And now he's embracing Donald Trump because it's required if that's how the Republicans in Texas are going to turn out to vote. O'Rourke, on the other hand, has garnered national appeal, has raised millions and millions of dollars from people both within and outside of Texas. And if he doesn't win this time around, he's probably indicating what the future in Texas will look like, because demographic changes and population shifts are going to make it very, very difficult for a Republican to continue to hold on. So Ted Cruz might make it through this time, but it doesn't seem like long term there are enough of those anti-CNN, pro-Trump, red voters to make sure that a Democrat doesn't take that seat.
Your thoughts on who might win that seat?
I think it goes to Cruz.
Another seat, the replacement for John McCain, McSally, a Republican, and Sinema, is that the proper pronunciation?
Yes.
A Democrat.
This
in Arizona.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting race because it's two women. So this is one race where a seat that has not been held by a woman now will be held by a woman. And you have two very unusual candidates. Martha McSally is a very conservative Republican, but she was also one of the first female fighter pilots. And she's been very, very proud of breaking a lot of glass ceilings in her life. So she's one of these Republican women that is pretty open about talking about what it means to be a woman in a male-dominated world. And that, in a lot of ways, is appealing, especially to independent voters. Kyrsten Sinema, on the other hand, has basically kept her head down and worked really hard in the House and is very, very well-liked and has a lot of national appeal as well. And if there's anybody that thinks that when women run against each other, the races won't be as dirty or as mean-spirited, they need to look at this contest because this is also complete proof that two women are willing to get in the mud just as easily as two men. So it's a tough race. It's hard to know, ultimately who's going to win this one. It will likely come down to voter turnout.
Any thoughts on who might win this one?
You know, this is one of these races where if the Democrats overall have a really good night, it could be an upset and Sinema could take it. But if I had to bet today, I would say it probably goes to McSally.
I'm all about betting. I've had a lot of fun in Las Vegas. How about Mississippi? I'm not even sure I know if I can explain this one properly. So Mississippi, let's see, had a November special election. Right. And because of that, they have two open seats. I'm going to let you do this one. I think I've lost my properly how this worked out.
So Mississippi is tricky because they're going to have the election in November, but then there will be a runoff if nobody gets the 50%. And so it's likely that this is going to remain a Republican seat. But this is one of those races where, because of the electoral rules, strange things can happen. So we'll know a lot more after Tuesday, actually, about who's
something
probably going to hold it.
Jungle primary is what I made note of.
So Louisiana has jungle primaries also. In these cases, the Democrats and the Republicans all run in the same primary, basically. So it's not a partisan primary. It's like one big election. And the top two vote getters then make it to the general election. That means that sometimes you'll have two Republicans, sometimes you'll have two Democrats. It won't necessarily be a partisan heading off against somebody from the other party.
Right. So two Republicans could actually hurt each other, right?
So two Republicans that are very popular that split the vote could actually ensure that a Democrat takes that second
takes a seat.
Yes.
Right.
And then you wind up with a Democrat versus a Republican.
Right.
So the competition there is the unknown there is who are going to be the two people that advance to the runoff.
Yeah. All right. Again, our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Wallace from UVA's Department of Politics. As we're talking politics, something you haven't been doing or hearing about over the last month, if you'd saved all the flyers that you've gotten over the last month, that's something I wanted to get. I had Leslie Coburn on to start the month of October, and I didn't ask her this question, although it was just such a bug in my head. And I was trying to be polite because I like to treat my shows as polite shows. If people are going to take their hour and bring them here, the show is not meant to be rude or impolite. But if you're going to have an email in my email box every day, if you're going to have a piece of mail in my mailbox every day, if I'm going to have to hear your voice on my radio every day, are you going to turn me off so that I don't want to vote for you at some point? What are your thoughts on that?
Political science studies suggest that there's no downside to bothering the heck out of people. And so the problem becomes if you stop doing that, or if you only touch a voter once or twice, or if you're only on the airwaves a couple of times before an election, and your opponent is running a more vibrant campaign and is contacting his or her supporters more often or putting up more lawn signs or, you know, buying more points on TV, is that going to matter? No one wants to take that risk. We don't know for sure because nobody wants to run a campaign with one arm tied behind his or her back. So instead, we wind up with this race to the bottom where both candidates are spending all of their time bothering voters and hoping that it's going to work.
Just like, oh my gosh, will somebody shut up? That's how I felt about that. And you know, and I was trying to be nice. I didn't want to ask her, but oh, good grief, please. How about, you know, Taylor Swift? Now, Taylor Swift, not running, by the way, for those who recognize the name, Taylor Swift, pop singer who has not been involved in politics, comes out and endorses the Democrat in Tennessee, the Senate Democrat running, Phil Bredesen versus Marsha Blackburn, something that she's never done before, and everybody went nuts. Talk about that.
I think there's this general sense that when people who are apolitical or who have not shared their political views are willing to put it out there, potentially to the detriment of their own reputation, ostensibly Taylor Swift has a lot of Republican fans as well, it means something. And so the fact that she went out and said, look, Marsha Blackburn is not somebody that we can afford to have in the Senate. I'm putting my support behind Phil Bredesen. That generates national attention for Bredesen, and it also sends a signal to Swift supporters that maybe this is a race, if they're eligible, that they should cast votes in. Now, celebrity endorsements are by no means a new thing. In 2008, probably the most consequential endorsement we've ever seen was when Oprah Winfrey came out in support of Barack Obama. Here was somebody else. She had superstar status. She had never been involved in politics. And she said that he was the candidate for her. He made her believe. We don't know ultimately how much that endorsement in and of itself matters. But when somebody like Oprah or Taylor Swift go out in support of a candidate, it probably doesn't hurt. And we see Oprah now campaigning for Stacey Abrams to be the first black female governor of Georgia as well. So as long as these celebrities are pretty discriminating in who they support, those endorsements can garner quite a bit of attention.
But it wasn't that she just endorsed them. It was, I mean, she had a spike in voter registration. Voter.org said that they went from 14,000 daily visitors to 156,000 in just the couple days, you know, that day and for the following week.
Right. And again, I think it's because it's relatively unusual. So there were people that she communicates with who might not be the typical person that the campaigns themselves were encouraging to vote. Now, whether those voter registration numbers turn into actual ballots cast is an open question, but there's no question that Phil Bredesen was happy with the way that the endorsement worked out.
All right. So we'll come back to the House. Let's talk about a couple topics. We'll take a break and then come back and talk to those. I'm going to talk about Kavanaugh. We'll talk about Pittsburgh and the bombs, but 39 after the hour, before we get deep into the Kavanaugh issue, no need to be broken up by that. Wake up call on Sunday morning on WPVC. Hang tight, everybody. Back in action here on Sunday morning wake up call with Professor Jennifer Lawless. I'm having a good time. Everybody else having a good time?
I'm having a good time.
That's because you're talking politics. That's what you do to have fun.
It is.
What's it like to, you know, enjoy talking politics earlier in life and then go get a job where you get to do that?
It's pretty amazing. Election day is like my Super Bowl, so I'm excited that it's coming, but sad it'll be over.
Well, then you just go have to write a book about it. find some kids who pay to like sit in your class while you talk about it.
It's a hard life.
Yeah. Well, I'll have you back on in the spring and you can come tell me more about it and we'll do it all over again. So does a topic such as Kavanaugh issue increase the number of voters, actually, because the news cycle about that has now passed, right? So while it might have increased people to register to vote, it certainly sparked people to make their voices heard, and it might have changed their minds. But what does it do for Tuesday?
I think that the effects for Tuesday are different for Democrats and Republicans. And by that, I mean that the Kavanaugh hearings and what they represented were part of a much broader narrative for the Democrats. The Democrats had been running a campaign since November of 2016, suggesting that Donald Trump and the Republicans are out of touch with women, don't respect women's rights, and don't really value the kind of diversity and inclusion that have come to be part of the American ethos that so many people enjoy. And the way that the Senate handled, the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee anyway, the way that they handled the Kavanaugh hearings and the way that they demonstrated that they were willing to confirm him despite these allegations helped the Democrats put forward yet one more example of this narrative that they've been running on for 2 years. So in some ways, I think Kavanaugh helped the Democrats because it kept alive a lot of the themes that they had been talking about. Initially, it seemed like the Kavanaugh hearings also energized the Republicans. Donald Trump went out there and said, look, guys, you should be worried. You should be worried about your sons. This is the way that we're treating men. This is terrible. And there seemed to have been an uptick in enthusiasm that the audacity of the Democrats to sink this nominee or to try to sink this nominee was enough to get people to the polls. But that was short-lived, and that was several weeks ago. And in politics, that seems like a lifetime ago. So because that wasn't part of a broader Republican message, I don't think that it really resonates the same way that it did for Democrats. And I don't think that it's going to matter that much on Tuesday for Republicans.
Really, tell me why. Because at the time, the GOP was using that as its issue as to why it was so important and necessary. I mean, I love that Saturday Night Live piece on the locker room and sort of why you needed to get out and effectively needed to get out and vote and why this was an important piece on why we had to win.
And the Republicans have since pivoted, and now they're talking all about immigration and the threat that the caravan poses to this country. And the reality is that most voters are paying attention the few weeks right before the election. If the Kavanaugh timing was different, and if the hearing had been last week as opposed to last month, I think it might have mattered a little bit more. But the people that are voting Republican because they care about Supreme Court nominees and they care about an anti-choice court were already voting Republican. That wasn't going to be enough long term, I don't think, to spur them to register and to turn out. And the fact that the Republicans have pivoted and their message is now focused more on immigration, which was very successful for Trump in 2016, suggests that they've changed their strategy as well.
So let's talk about the caravan. How does that play a role in the voting issue, immigration, and getting people out to vote on Tuesday?
We know from 2016 that from the minute that Donald Trump came down that elevator in Trump Tower and said that immigrants posed a major threat to the United States, that was in his opening speech when he announced his campaign, and he said that a lot of the Mexican immigrants are rapists, they're murderers. That message resonated with his core group of supporters and a base that ultimately was willing to stand by and let this man say and do anything. When he said, you know, I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and 40% of the population would still support me, those are those people. And what we're seeing now is language reminiscent of 2015 and 2016 about the threat that immigrants pose. Just last week, Donald Trump said that they're going to treat rocks as rifles, suggesting that if the people in this caravan in any way, shape or form pose even the mildest threat to a law enforcement official, they're going to treat these people not as though they're throwing a rock, but as though they have a missile or a firearm. And it's that kind of histrionic response that has really resonated with this core group of Trump supporters who the Republicans need on Election Day if they're to stop the bleeding in the House and maintain control of the Senate.
Do you believe that there are enough? Because now we've had Paul Ryan again. These people, politicians seem to disagree with Donald Trump, current politicians in Washington, D.C. Let me throw those phrases in there. Seem to make comments disagreeing with Donald Trump on their way out the door. Paul Ryan disagrees, makes disagreeing statements with Donald Trump in the last week, 10 days. Do you think that others will say things similar to Paul Ryan about the caravan in the next day or two? Or do you think that nothing will be said until after Election Day?
No Republican is going to disagree with Donald Trump regarding immigration in the next 48 hours. And that's because there's too much uncertainty. Paul Ryan is not facing the electorate again. Jeff Flake, who, and Bob Corker, both in the Senate, who have in some ways disagreed with Trump, not only over immigration, but over taxes and health care and the Kavanaugh hearings as well, were only vocal because they didn't have to face the voters again. I think it's going to take Tuesday's election results to send a signal to Republicans as to what they can say and what they can't say. If it turns out that there is no blue wave and Donald Trump somehow manages to maintain Republican control in the House and the Senate, then no Republican is going to bash anything that he says ever again because he was able to do the impossible. If it turns out that some of the candidates that Trump has been the most supportive of, some of the candidates who have adopted Trump's language, lose their elections, then that might free up some of these Republicans to say the kinds of things that maybe they've wanted to say, that maybe they believe, but they've worried could ultimately cost them votes on Election Day. Not necessarily because their voters would disagree with them, but because that and Donald Trump campaigning against them would be a little bit too much to bear.
Let's go back and talk about some of these candidacies. We have House California 48, which is Dana Rohrabacher, who's a Republican, in his 16th term as running against Harley Ruda, Democrat. You would think that this would be an easy one for the Republicans, and yet it's being talked about as though a possible flip.
There are dozens of districts across the country, and this one falls into that category, where Republicans have been able to hold the district, often by double digits, both in terms of the incumbents getting reelected and the vote share that presidential candidates have gotten in the last cycle, that are up for grabs this time around. And that's for two reasons. The first is in California, in Texas, and Arizona, there are demographic changes in these districts, which suggests that the composition of the district looks a little bit different. But second, there are people who are motivated to vote this time around because they don't like the direction the country is headed in. And in 2016, either staying home or perhaps voting for Donald Trump if you were an independent seemed like a plausible thing to do. The odds of the country sort of exploding the way that it has and it looking unrecognizable to a lot of people was hypothetical. It wasn't real. And some of the candidates running for Congress this time around have aided and abetted the Trump agenda, often to the detriment of their voters. And I think we're seeing dozens of these people run for their lives this time around.
Who do you think is going to win that one? The incumbent Rohrabacher or the or Harley Ruda, the Democrat?
I mean, I think Rohrabacher is not a shoo-in. I'm not sure. Like, this one, I think, could go either way. But the fact that it's even competitive suggests that a lot has changed in 2 years.
We have the House Kentucky 06, Andy Barr, Republican incumbent, versus Amy McGrath, Democrat. She's a fighter pilot mom.
She is, and she's run incredibly compelling ads. She's sort of taken on a national presence, and it's not a very partisan race. She's just talking about core values. She's talking about protecting our kids. She's talking about defending this nation. And doing it in a way that indicates a general sense of respect for everybody that lives here. And in a lot of ways, she's become this progressive icon and has raised an incredible amount of money from people inside and outside of Kentucky. So if I had to make a prediction there, I'd say that she wins that race.
Here's an interesting, I don't even know who this gentleman is running against, but House Pennsylvania 17, Connor Lamb in March won the upset race. This was one of those special elections. But now he's been redistricted so he's got to run again from March. He's going in November. So does he win again? Or does now, I think he's running against an incumbent in November from a new one?
So the upside is that he just recently ran and won an election that he should not have won, which means that he never closed down his campaign and he is able to sustain the kind of name recognition and support that he had gotten all along. Now, the voters are somewhat different, but he's got a decent shot at winning. And if Pennsylvania turnout is very, very high, and there is a suggestion that the recent events in Pittsburgh will probably heighten turnout in Pennsylvania, he might be able to make it through.
Can we ask a question about one or two of the Virginia? I know the national is more your scene. Mm-hmm. But how about Charlottesville's 7th district, the Bratt versus Spanberger?
I think he goes down.
Do you think Spanberger's going to win that?
I do, for a couple of reasons. The first is that, you know, Dave Bratt defeated Eric Cantor in a complete upset that nobody expected, largely because Cantor was seen as being too inside Washington. He wasn't resonating with his district. He wasn't spending much time coming back to the district. And Bratt now seems to have fallen into the same trap. He doesn't like the way that a lot of his constituents have approached him. He doesn't like the way that people have treated him hostily. He doesn't like town halls because he has to defend his opinion in a very intimate setting and finds it somewhat unappealing. And in a lot of ways, he's become Eric Cantor. And so if you just look on his website versus his opponent's website, you know, she's literally had something like 200 events in the last month alone where she's trying to go out and meet every single voter that she possibly can. And that seems to matter in this district. It's part of what got Dave Bratt elected in the first place. So the district demographics, which lean Republican, but not in a crazy way, plus the very individualized nature of this race, suggests that this could be one of the seats that the Democrats add to their column.
And let's talk about the district that covers Charlottesville and Albemarle. How about Coburn, the Democrat, versus Riggleman, the Republican?
If voter turnout is through the roof, then I think Coburn has a shot. But if, again, I had to make a prediction today, I would say that it's Riggleman. And that's largely because the demographics in this district suggest that it shouldn't even be competitive. With the exception of the very blue pocket of Charlottesville, this is a pretty red Republican, you know, rural kind of district. And Riggleman is resonating with large swaths of those voters. As a result, it's really become a referendum on the Trump administration. This is not a district where you're seeing campaigns that are really specific to what's going on in Virginia 5. Instead, what you're really seeing is, do you want Trump's agenda moving forward, or do you want the Democrats in Congress to stop him? And at the end of the day, if Leslie Coburn can get out enough Democrats, she could potentially win. But, you know, the onus is on her to do it. And the math is really, really hard.
Again, our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Lawless, UVA's Department of Politics, as we talk nothing but politics. So exciting. And next week, by the way, Professor Sid Milkus will be here from UVA's Department of Politics as we clean up and talk the history of Tuesday and what happened. Just a few minutes left. So, you know, Professor Trump is saying the vote is all about me. Make sure that, you know, treat it as my name is on the ballot. And I want your opinion on how that's going to play out when we do have a blue wave or a blue puddle tick or whichever way you think it's going to go. What's he going to, how's he going to talk about that? Because he always seems to turn things around and blame somebody else.
He'll say he didn't say it. And they'll show him the tape of him saying it, and he'll say that wasn't me. I mean, the one thing that's kind of incredible about Trump and this administration is that evidence of them saying one thing to them is not evidence that they ever said it. And so if Donald Trump is unable to deliver a Republican victory in the House, he's going to say that it was not his fault. It was these candidates.
But what if it's on Fox News? I mean, it's one thing if he says CNN miscut that or NBC treated that.
He'll say that it was taken out of context. He'll say that the fact that the Republicans were able to hold any seat is validation of his agenda. And this is what makes it very, very frustrating, I think, for a lot of political observers, because Donald Trump has changed the rules about what he's willing to acknowledge. You know, in 2010, when the Democrats lost a lot of seats, Barack Obama walked up to the podium and said, wow, like that was a shellacking. And when Bill Clinton lost seats in 94 and Newt Gingrich came to power with part of the Republican Revolution, Clinton said, "Oy, we're going to have to step back and figure out how we're going to do things." I guarantee that we are not going to see any kind of autopsy performed by Trump or the Trump administration if it turns out there is a big wave on Tuesday.
Oh, my. So what do you do for your next book?
I'm actually doing a book on local media and whether the death of newspapers and local media is contributing to the decay in civic engagement and political knowledge. And at a time when I think facts are more important than they've ever been, it seems very, very important to be able to track where people are getting their news, how reliable it is, and whether it's becoming decreasingly accessible.
Where are they getting their news?
At the local level, they're still getting it from newspapers that are covering less and less, which means that they're becoming less and less informed.
I don't even know where to ask the next question, because how many issues of the newspaper are even put out there? And I thought that they weren't, you know, if you go to your local newspaper, there's only like six people who work there.
That's right. And there's virtually no coverage of politics, yet they remain the main source of political information for everything at the local level. And given that we have 500,000 local elected positions, there's a crisis.
Well, I hope you'll come back on and talk about that.
I'd love to.
All right. Professor Jennifer Lawless here today. And next week, Professor Sid Milkus, and we'll talk about exactly what happens on Tuesday. Once again, Sunday morning wake-up call. This is 94.7 WPVC. Thank you so much. Talk to you next week.
This has been the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The wake-up call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SevillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of the wake-up call, only on 94.7 WPVC.